One, two, Freddy's coming for you. We're talking A Nightmare on Elm Street. Hit it. It was 1984. A 700-year-old wing of York Minster was destroyed by a fire. Stevie Wonder just called to say I love you. Sony made the first 3.5-inch computer disc, and Nancy fought a vengeful child murderer spirit in her dreams. I'm your host, Jerry D, with another episode of Totally Rad Christmas, Halloween, the podcast that talks all things Halloween in the 80s. Toys, movies, specials, music, and fads. If it was gnarly during Halloween in the 80s, we got it covered. Now, joining me is a very special guest. You'll know him as a host or one of the hosts of the Nostaljunk podcast, Matt McGrath. Matt, how's it going?
I'm great. What a sweet intro. I almost joined you. I almost was like, 3, 4.
You should have. That would have been fun.
Yeah. But you're a well-oiled self-directed one-man show here. So this is cool.
I might have done it once or twice. Yeah, something like that.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. So cool to chat Nightmare on Elm Street. I absolutely love this movie. I think it's one of the most original horror movies ever.
Yes. Yes. I mean, everything from like how it kind of came about, the whole idea to just its execution is, I mean, it's kind of amazing that it even got made, honestly.
Timeless.
Yeah.
I actually just watched it before we started recording with the commentary track. Oddly enough, the commentary track was the commentary track that was a part of the Laserdisc that was released in 94. Nice. So they're talking about how good the transfer looks and calling it the Laserdisc.
Wow.
And it's Wes, Heather, John, and the director of photography. And I'm thinking, like, just wait until you see what we're dealing with now. Because they're like, ooh, this looks too crisp. You can see the wire in that scene.
4K.
Yeah,
it's
pretty much.
I mean, yeah, it's crazy. And I remember I was in sixth grade and in science class. This is like one of those memories that you just never forget. And having to watch like a couple of videos and the teacher just bringing out the big old laser disc, and you know, we'd watch a little bit of it and then she'd have to stop it because it was over and then flip it over and we'd finish it. And it I mean, it still blows my mind to think about how we used to do stuff like that. It's unbelievable.
Whenever you went into any classroom and the TV stand was set up, you knew you were in for a good day.
Oh yeah, for real. It was like, oh great, okay, so we're gonna work a little bit and the rest is just easy. Mm-hmm. Especially if there was a substitute teacher instead.
Oh yeah, you could totally bully them into anything.
Pretty much, yeah. It was good stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're talking Nightmare on Elm Street here. You know, what's your general like experience, your history with Nightmare on Elm Street?
Well, so Nightmare on Elm Street has probably my most nostalgic tie to horror movies. Not only just as a series, but it's the icon known as Freddy.
Yeah.
Like he was Hulk Hogan. He was
nice.
He was Metallica. He was the character that you did not need to see to know what he did because he was everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was it was so weird. It was like it as a Jaws fan, that's my favorite horror movie of all time.
Nice.
But as a Jaws fan, you kind of root for the shark.
Yeah.
Because you want to see the gore. You want to see the violence. Sure. Freddy was the first to actually have a charismatic character that
true.
Evolved, for better or for worse, through the series. But
he definitely got more snarky, that's for sure.
Well, the one-liners, I mean, that's something to be desired, but it was his thing. And it reinforced that love of the bad guy.
Yeah.
You know, he was a heel.
He'd come out
as the bad guy, but then you're rooting for him because you just hate the other character so much that you're like, well, they deserve to die, clearly. And it's just this weird mental switch that happens in your head when you're watching these movies and you get lost in the universe of like, okay, it's safe to root for the people that die here because it's not real.
Right.
It's also safe to root for a burnt man that lives in your dreams. In any case, I just think it was such a cool character. He spoke, he wasn't afraid to show himself, and he lived in your dreams, which is also a super huge advantage that he has over the POV stalkers in the woods and the ones looking in through the window at the babysitter for what was the slasher craze of the 80s.
Right.
I mean, obviously, without, revisiting all of that discussion, but, 1978, John Carpenter, Halloween.
Yeah.
I mean, arguably, you could say the elements that influenced that could have come from Bob Clark's Black Christmas of 74. But nonetheless, it was so close to the 80s that you can literally see the cash-in mentality of how the production companies were saying, like, oh, we just need to copy the formula known as Halloween and just make all these other movies. Now, needless to say, it was pretty sweet because as horror fans, we get to have tons of movies.
I mean, you think about like how many icons were born out of that, Jason, yes. Michael Myers, what's his name? The minor character. I can't remember his name from
Valentine Bluff.
That one. Yeah, I mean, just like all those,
Yeah. And even if they only had one appearance, like My Bloody Valentine, The Prowler, they were still iconic figures from that era.
Right.
Now, obviously, maybe we can revisit this around Christmas time, but we got to do some Christmas slashers. But I think Freddy is the top of all of them because he's got cool kills.
Yeah,
he has a cool character. He has a series that was not only beloved and followed, but endured the ages. And the same can be said about horror movies and slashers and really just 80s movies that were really kind of pushed to be made. Sometimes they're a product of their time, rushed script, all that kind of stuff that maybe they were just trying to play up to Freddy because Robert Englund was so good at playing this campy, cheesy Fred Astaire hybrid of a killer that people were just like, I just want Freddy. I don't want a story. I just want Freddy. And I think that's where his legacy found him until about part 7, where they want to make him scary again.
Yeah.
And then I think Freddy versus Jason was actually a really good movie for both of them. So I say all of that to say Freddy is my favorite iconic slasher horror movie of the 80s. Definitely.
So this is where I have to make a confession. I didn't actually see A Nightmare on Elm Street till the 90s.
Okay, so we'll just end the call here.
Yeah, it's just one of those. My parents weren't really into horror, so we just never really saw it. So the first one I saw was actually New Nightmare.
Oh, okay.
It's actually not bad, in the whole series. But then I went back and started watching them, and the first one just is, I mean, it's clearly the best. Freddy is malevolent. He's got this like this savagery, this brutality about him.
Incredible.
I mean, it just, the effects are definitely of their time. But like when Tina's like ripping his when his face is getting ripped off and you see like the skull and everything. I mean, that legit was a scary moment, especially, I mean, I think for the 80s, So it's like one of those they did with the budget that they had. I mean, they really knocked it out of the park.
Yeah, it was paper thin, that budget.
And
I think they said it was $1.8 million
was
the the budget on it. Yeah.
Yeah. It was supposed to be like 700,000 and, but they went over it. I think it was like, like 1.1 or something like that.
Just think of that. 1983, let's say they were producing it because it came out in 84. It
came out of, that's about right.
What kind of movie are you making with that little money, right? And expecting
Sleepaway Camp, that's it.
I know. Another great one.
That's another good one, yeah.
But go on. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I'm just, it's just surprising that it actually did as well as it did with not only the budget, but I mean, just what they had, the materials that they had at the time. And they had to get really creative. So the whole idea of like the glove with the knives on it, I mean, that's like a scary imagery right there. You know, yeah, there's a guy with a knife or a guy with an axe or machete, whatever. But this dude who's like, he's got these long knives for his fingers. I mean, like that, I remember as a kid, I hadn't seen the movie, but I remember like being terrified of this guy when I would see him, all the other little kids running around dressed as him for Halloween, you know, and then his face, you know, and of course, Wes Craven said that, you know, he wanted him to kind of have a mask, but without actually having a mask so he could emote and, you know, and things like that. And so instead they kind of went with that burn and that scarring. But I mean, it's something about it is even creepier than I think than Michael Myers' mask or just a hockey mask from Jason. I mean, or even Leatherface, which I mean, that's like another human face, but still something about Freddy's face is just a,
a couple faces.
Well, yeah.
For Leatherface.
Touche. Yeah, yeah.
Even but, like a nipple belt.
But I mean, it's just, you know, then you see Freddy and it's it was like on a whole nother level there, just with the scars and the burns. And I mean, it was terrifying in its own right. And it also, you know, so much so that when they kind of tried to copy it a little bit when Robert Englund played the Phantom of the Opera in that movie. I don't know if you remember that version.
I watched that recently, actually. Yeah.
Oh, wow. I haven't seen that since like the late 80s, early 90s, something like that.
Yeah. I loved video stores when we would have been, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, and just creep in those aisles. And you'd end up in the horror section looking at titles and covers you knew damn well you shouldn't have been picking up anyway. And then as soon as you did, you'd see something super horrific and then it would burn in your brain. And then 30 plus years later, here we are again. And we're still buying this stuff because we just can't get over our own nostalgia.
And
here we are. We're two guys talking remotely about something from 1984 with our nerd love of it.
Heck yeah. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is definitely one of those movies that, yes, it's kind of like you said, he's evolved throughout. He's gotten a little more campy. But I think that's why I like him better. You know, I mean, none of the other, like the Silent Stalker types, you know, I mean, literally they were just, they're just a presence, which is scary in and of itself. But the fact that Freddy could taunt you, and I think that made it worse when he would say your name. Like, I think, I mean, as a kid, you know, you knew you were in trouble when your mom like yelled your name, especially your full name. But you know, it's just it kind of resonates that, you know, when he's like Tina or Nancy. I mean, it just, like, I can imagine these teenagers, because I mean, Tina's supposed to be what, like 15 years old, I think, in the movie. Something like that.
Yeah, but, they're pretty young.
Yeah. But I mean, it's just, you can imagine the fear and that it would actually inspire in them. And that's just crazy to me. I don't think I could deal with it. I think I'd probably end up like the others, dead.
And I think that's what's so relatable about the movie, is that as we matured, like I saw this before I was a teenager.
Right.
Again, shouldn't have, but did. Yeah, you know,
all right.
Again, going back to why Freddy was so big,
it was the 80s.
And so huge, right? I mean, parents were like, "Ah, oh, this is entertaining. You're out of my hair. Hit play."
Yep.
But the merchandising, like how are you marketing a child-safe Freddy glove for a movie they're not allowed to see?
Yeah.
Same goes for the argument I have for, you know, like, how did you make a kid's cartoon for RoboCop?
There's a Christmas episode of that too,
right?
Yeah.
Like it if you can market it as a toy, that was the mindset of the 80s. They're like, just go ahead, just market it. So I was five, I had the Freddy glove. Of course, now I need to know who Freddy is, right?
Yeah, you know, of course, like, naturally.
And, And then my dad had some of these sweet hardcover horror research books, I guess. They were more like kind of like the overview and of just everything horror, like through the ages, like The Hammer into, you know, a modern era of the 80s.
Right, right.
And of course, these horrific graphic images that that I was just obsessed with. I just loved it. And it wasn't like I wanted to, thank God, like complete or execute any of these actions. That
like,
I
let
saw,
me watch my words like here.
It was like a morbid fascination
of
fantasy and escapism that, you know, it's the same as someone, you know, putting on a first person shooter and, you know, in today or VR experience, you know, it's just to tap out and escape and let off some steam. And I think that's what horror does, but horror does a lot more. And, I think to Freddy's credit, because he exists in the dream world, he can go anywhere.
Yeah. And that's a really good point there. And you mentioned it earlier that he kind of has an advantage over all these other guys. And he really does, because he's basically non-corporeal. I mean, he's literally just kind of lives in this other psychic plane of dreamscape or whatever you want to call it. So really it's like, how do you kill him? How do you fight that? Of course, we get the Dream Warriors later on, but
and a sweet song by Dokken.
Yeah, that's on my playlist.
still such a badass song.
It really is. Yeah.
So just the relatability of the teens and the kids in the movie is that they act probably the most accurate or the most like close that you can in this situation. If you look at Friday the 13th, everyone's having a great time at summer camp and they just keep getting killed off.
Yeah. One at a time.
This movie, everyone's tortured the entire time. And it's in the real world and it's in the dream world because they're all experiencing this one experience that's shared throughout the entirety of the film. And their whole goal is that they're just trying to stay awake. So this also comes at the point of the oversaturation plateau of the slashers. You know, slashers, like I said, I would say, let's for argument's sake, 1980, Friday the 13th is when, you know, the commercialized slasher product is when it's really going. Halloween's number one, but when we're talking about when the ball starts rolling,
production
companies are saying, you got to make cheap movies, super quick, lots of kills, boobies, and you know, sell lots of tickets. And it worked. It was a tried, test and true formula. I mean, I would say probably there was like at least 200 movies made in 3 years, you know, just right there. And they didn't have to be good. They just had to have some sweet scenes in them.
Yeah.
But it was oversaturated. Nightmare on Elm Street comes out in 84, which is surprisingly at the end of the surge of good stuff. And it kind of reinvigorates, like, what is a slasher? What is a horror movie? What is a killer? And so not only does he exist in the dreams, but he exists as a character, not just a shape, a figure in the woods,
right?
A stalker, you know? He quarters you in your mind and then kills you. So as a teen, trying to escape that, what are you going to do? You're going to do what Nancy does at the end of the movie. You go full Goonies. You start booby trapping the house. She's like, you know what? I'm going to bring him out into my world.
Yeah.
I'm going to blow him up with some light bulbs. And there she is filing away with the gunpowder. Luckily, her dad's a cop, so she has access to gunpowder.
Of course, naturally. You got to have the cop dad. Otherwise, are you even a slasher film? You know,
right? And she's already barred in the house, so she's a little bit hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo. Yeah. And her mom's a drunk, so she's going to be passed out, not going to hear any of this.
Yeah.
So this is, it's a perfect, it's
like
a perfect
win,
storm.
Win, win, win. Yeah.
Oh, man. Just such a perfect storm of a movie. and it's still timeless. And I think that that's the struggle of teens is, you know, how to stay close. Parents don't get each other. You got to have each other's backs. And that's, I think that's the crux of the camaraderie, the synergy of Nightmare on Elm Street is trying to work together.
Right.
To stay alive.
Yeah, I gotcha. Well, and I mean, I think even Heather Langenkamp has even said that, she, you know, yes, it's kind of a feminist film, I guess, because, you know, the final girl survives, but she sees it more as actually like a teen power or youth empowerment kind of film.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it's interesting when the main actress says that, then, you know, you got to pay attention, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, well, she was fantastic in that movie.
And, she really was. Yeah. Yeah. And, I enjoy
and
her.
Not just a product of her time. I mean, she's a total babe.
Yeah. I was always more into Tina.
Yeah. Okay. All right. All right.
A little more my style.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever.
There's something about being dragged across the ceiling that's really super attractive. Well,
I mean, so much so that they copied it in the Scary Movie or whatever, Scary Movie 2, whatever it was. Yeah, one of those.
Well, that's another thing, is the homage that comes from a big movie.
Yeah.
You know, if imitation is a sincere form of flattery, then Nightmare on Elm Street is right up there with Psycho, Jaws, etc. Because, like, look at all those infamous scenes. You know, the, like, Freddy in the shadows with the long arms. The guys were controlling with fishing wire and from, you know, like, they actually have fishing rods on the roofs, like, just to control those stupid long arms. Like, just all the little things of that movie that kind of go unnoticed that to this day, if you see it mimicked, you say, oh, that's from Nightmare on Elm Street.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, you know, of course, like you said, there's just so many iconic moments. So we get the spinning room, we get the geyser of blood. You know, that's, I mean, that to me was terror right there. I remember, you know, watching that for the first time. And even though I was, I think I was already like 12 or something, but it got me. I was like, what the heck? I mean, like, that's a lot of blood. And like, what did he have to do to Glenn to make that much blood come out that fast? You know, like, you think about that and then your mind starts to work and it just starts to mess with you. And in a lot of ways, that's even scarier than actually seeing him do it.
Well, that's
like that whole Lovecraftian idea, you know, where he wouldn't really explain anything. He would just talk about like the madness that set in from what they saw. And, you know, and that really makes your own mind kind of just go crazy. So I always really loved that, at least in that scene in particular. But, you know, when Tina's being murdered all around the room and just, I mean, just the fact that they actually built, you know, the spinning room, I thought was really cool. And then of course they use it in Breaking 2, Electric Boogaloo. So, you know, you gotta give them props for that, for letting them, use it, I guess I should say.
Yeah. 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 I mean, like that, behind the scenes discussion, that reminds me of what Kubrick did for 2001 with the Centrifuge, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he built a spaceship replica essentially, and then mounted the camera ingeniously just so that it moved to create that sense of either weightlessness or the shift of perspective. Like, they're still studying the way that he filmed a couple of those long hallway shots.
Yeah.
And it's similar to, not to the extent, but, you know, Wes did the best he could, and the crew, to create something to shift perspective. You know, you keep things nailed down, you keep things stiff, you know, something that's supposed to blow up is now weighted. You know, they did that. So in Tina's death and then in Johnny Depp's death, where they flipped the room. And, like I said, I watched it just before we hit record, and I was looking at things like the phone cord, how it's all coiled.
Yeah,
it did not move. So, like, that thing was ironclad, that whole set,
which is, I mean, it's amazing when you think about that they could actually do that and get a good shot. I mean, of course, I know they ended up using, like, I think just colored water because it wasn't working out, but I mean, you had to be, and that's what I love about the style of filmmaking, and, like, especially in this era, like, you had to be creative and you had to be inventive because you didn't have a computer to just do it, you know. Not that
I rely on things.
Exactly. Yeah. Not that I hate CGI. I don't. I love CGI, but, you know, I think it works best when there's a good mix of practical and computer effect. And in this case, I mean, they didn't have it. So, you know, let's dye the water red and let's make it look just this huge blood splatter. And let's turn the room upside down, because what else can we do?
That's amazing.
It really is. And every time I think about it, it just blows my mind how amazing. And I would love to be on that crew and just like sitting there thinking, you know, like smoking your cigarette, like, what if we turned the room upside down, you know, or something like that.
Yeah, because back then you could smoke a cigarette inside. Also, right.
Yeah, there's a lot.
I don't know if I'd actually want to be involved in the crew on that day, because when they shot all the blood and filmed upside down, the water electrified anything that was plugged in.
Yep.
So there were crews standing in basically the pools of bloody water that was now charged. And they're still trying to hit record straight faced, you know. I know you're a wrestling fan,
that's dedication, you know, right there. You know,
a botch happens. You got to see it through.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly
Stone
right.
Stone Cold Steve Austin gets a body slam from Yokozuna, hits his pants, and then he hits the mat. You got to finish the match.
You got to. That's right. You know, your string breaks while you're playing the tune. You just keep soloing on a different string. You know.
That's it.
Yeah.
And if you can't. Back, take some lessons.
Yep. Or have your roadie quickly switch it out as fast as possible.
Oh, okay. All right. So now you're implying you got money. All right.
Well, not me, but you know, I'm sure that happens too.
That's
weird. Yeah. Oh man. But I mean, I guess we could just get into the plot really quickly. You know, I mean,
oh, did you want me to hit record? Are we ready?
He'll be here all week.
Yeah. Hey, try the
no, he really will, but also all year, because it's a podcast and you can listen to it whenever. So all the time. Yeah. But I mean, essentially, if we want to nutshell it, it's basically the spirit of a I guess lynched child murderer comes back to haunt the children of his murderers. Mm. Of his own murders. Mm. Yeah, that's okay. I'm sure there's a better way I can say it, but for now, I mean, that's, you know, there you go. And that's the nutshell version. And we get these teens that have to like survive.
Yes.
Of course, the main actress is Nancy Thompson. Her dad is he's a lieutenant, I think, or is he the chief? I don't remember. He's a lieutenant, right. Yeah. And you got to have like I said, you got to have the cop dad, just like in Halloween. Mm-hmm. I think John mm-hmm. Saxon also was a cop. I think he was also a lieutenant, wasn't he? In Black Christmas.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I picture John Saxon to always be a cop.
Yeah.
Or an investigator of some sort. Cause he was also in a giallo. What was it? Tenebrae or.
I don't think I've seen that one.
Yeah.
I know him actually more from Enter the Dragon, the Bruce Lee flick. That's where I know him.
Kyle is, he loves Kung Fu movies. And that was one that he rented a lot. He said,
oh man, Enter the Dragon's amazing. The score by Lalo Schifrin is,
oh my God.
Blows my mind every time. It's just,
but yeah, John Saxon, there was another one. I mean, I think maybe it's because of popularity due to Nightmare on Elm Street that kind of gave new life to older actors that, might have been aged out of other roles that find themselves now typecasted into being a cop or some sort of authority figure. He was in, God, what was it? Nightmare Beach or anyway, it's a bad movie, but saving grace was John Saxon.
So I understand. Yeah.
It's moments like that. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And something about it. I mean, his whole demeanor, he's got that gravitas, you know, that, even if he's not the best actor, he at least is a lot better than most of the cast that he's with, usually. Mm-hmm. And
well, he says in Nightmare on Elm Street, he says, what the hell were you doing going to school today anyway?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That sounds just like a parent.
It sure does.
Just so happens that he holds a gun. That's all.
Yep. Touche.
Speaking of composers that you just mentioned there, Charles Bernstein, you got to give him credit. To him for what he did with the soundtrack with a synthesizer. I mean, this is right up there with Brad Fidel's Terminator soundtrack, like those iconic synth soundscapes that they created with very, very simple cues and themes and motifs that just kind of revitalize themselves throughout the movie, mm-hmm. that the soundtrack itself is a character.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. I mean,
it's like the two notes from Jaws. It signifies death is coming.
Yeah, yeah, it's exactly. And of course, John Williams is a master of leitmotifs. But you know, when you get to Halloween and this genre as a whole, I think it kind of really started with. I guess you could argue it started with Jaws, but for this particular subgenre, I suppose, of horror. Then it really started with Halloween and John Carpenter. And of course we get that famous, you know, 5/4 little riff there that he played, but Charles Bernstein, he just knows exactly how to develop his music. And so we have some inversions, you know, we have some retrograde motifs and all sorts of things that just, but this was right around that time when like, everyone was experimenting with synthesizers. So like the mid to late 70s, you had Jerry Goldsmith using it in almost every single one of his scores. And of course he would still use the full orchestra as opposed to like, you know, like you were mentioning the Terminator soundtrack, you know, so it's like to be able to integrate the synth with the actual full orchestra, I think, is a rare gift. And I think Charles Bernstein did a fantastic job with that, whereas a lot of the other composers are not quite as good at it, I should say.
There's something to be said about subtlety. You know,
yes.
Less is more. Mm-hmm. You know, the horror of Jaws is not seeing the shark.
Right.
The horror of Freddy in the first Nightmare on Elm Street is not seeing Freddy. For a lot of the movie, he lives in the shadows.
Or he uses someone else, like the girl that she runs into. You know, it's like it's him, but it's not him. You know, in her dream.
Where's your past? Screw your past. So I mean, I think when you look at a movie, you have to look at all of the production elements that make the movie, right? If you muted the soundtrack, do you have the same effect? No, you don't.
And I'm proof of that because I actually used to teach a class on film scoring.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a great class. And so we would watch scenes without music and we'd watch scenes with music. And, you know, we'd talk about how they develop their leitmotifs and things like that. And, but whenever we would get to, you know, something a little more horror, oriented, you know, it was always more fun because the kids were really into it. So when we take the music out, it was so disenfranchising, I should say. I mean, it like the kids would just be tuned out of it completely.
Yeah. Whereas, almost awkward because when you know what it's supposed to sound like and then it's not there, you just hear like either really heavy breathing and scared sounds without any music to build tension again.
Yeah.
Like, could you imagine Psycho without Bernard Herrmann's low swells? Like not even the
major
sour spikes,
right?
Like just that, that it just creates such mood and drama, right?
Yeah,
And this movie has it too, even though it's done on a synth and it sounds like a product of its era. Bell, you know, FM piano kind of sound, but it's important. I think it's completely relevant to not only the fact that it's a moment in time that you can hit play on and it takes you right back to when it was made, the magic that made it of that era. But without that music, you wouldn't have the impact that it left on shows like Stranger Things and the culture that kind of embraces that retro synth wave of, you know, kind of the revisitation of that kind of stuff and celebration.
Yeah. And I mean, it makes sense if you think about it, since we're really gaining popularity. So yeah, like guys like Emerson, Lake and Palmer had been using the Moog and all sorts of things like that. But, you know, at this time where we're starting to see the Rhodes and other synths and, you know, they're just used in popular music now. So people are just used to that sound at this, in this point in time, you know, in this era. And so it makes sense to use it. You know, just like how they started using organ in, you know, to accompany chant in church, you know, in the ancient medieval times. I mean, it's kind of that same deal, you know, it's like, it's popular, let's use it. And so it really does make sense to kind of integrate that into your score or your orchestra, or just make it your primary instrument, like John Carpenter. So I get it. I get why they use it. And this is one of those scores that I haven't delved as deeply into as I'd like, just because I just never did. I mean, honestly.
Well, it's D minor. And if you're a Spinal Tap fan,
it's the saddest of all keys.
it's part of a trilogy. What's it called? It's Lick My Love Pump.
Yeah. Oh man, I love Spinal Tap. I got to find a way to do that on here too. I'm sure there's a way to cover it on the show. I'll find
it. Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Didn't they have a Christmas album?
They do. Yeah. Well, they don't have a Christmas album, but they have a Christmas song.
Yeah. Yeah. That's your tie-in.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, we'll take it.
Yeah. Yep. That's excellent. But yeah. Yeah. D minor. And then it shifts down to D flat as the meter changes.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah. I've always loved trying to learn horror themes on guitar, mm-hmm. because not until probably about the 2000s did guitars start working their way into scary scores.
Yeah, that's about right. That makes sense.
I think the one that comes to mind of a texture or was in Saw. Mm-hmm. That dun-dun-dun, 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 dun-dun-dun. And then there would be that guitar in the background. Now, of course, Charlie Clouser, mm-hmm. is, of Nine Inch Nails fame. So
right.
Not foreign to him to introduce distorted guitar by any means. So, I mean, that's a whole nother discussion too, is, horror movie music evolution. Yeah. But to stay back to this era, you've got Carpenter, Bernstein, even Fidel, like I said there. But Goblin, for doing all the giallo stuff. You've got a rock band, a psychedelic prog rock band with no vocals,
yeah,
being the backdrop to, the Mario Bavas and
what was that one? Fastway? Didn't they do a lot of the songs to Trick or Treat?
Oh my God. Wow. Okay. Not the angle I was going for, but fantastic. Now, speaking of obscurity, the song at the end of A Nightmare on Elm Street in the credits is performed by a band called 213.
Ooh, wow.
Only for this album. This is the only thing that you can really dig up. Anyway, they performed the song Nightmare. It's a nightmare. It's just a dream. And it's just so cheesy. Again, product of its time.
Yeah.
Amazing though. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's one of those that you think about Bloodsport and Stan Bush, and the Fight to Survive song, and you're just listening to it and it's not really a great song, but it is a legit great song. You know what I mean?
In the context of the movie, it's amazing.
Exactly. Yeah. And I would go work out to that song or something, but it's not one of those I'd just be like, hey, I feel like listening to Fight to Survive. It's kind of the same thing.
I think all that's missing from A Nightmare on Elm Street is Kenny Loggins soundtrack.
Can you imagine if Kenny Loggins wrote a score?
Now this is the danger zone.
Well, ba-doom. I think you got a bright future ahead of you as a podcaster.
If only there was a way I could figure out how to transpose A Nightmare on Elm Street into a Kenny Loggins.
I'm sure.
I'll get back to you next week.
I'm sure we can figure out something.
I'll get back to you next week.
I'm gonna have to Photoshop Kenny Loggins' face on Freddy's body now.
Ooh, I don't know who that's worse for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I see it. Yeah.
How'd you think in there?
This fantastic score. We get the movie opening with Freddy actually putting his iconic glove together.
Yes.
Which I always thought was so cool. Cause I mean, rarely do you get to see the villain actually create his weapon. I mean, I guess if you want, you get the Death Stars kind of still being built in Return of the Jedi. I don't know if that counts. But I mean, it's mostly just like a knife, just an axe, you know, you just grab something. But this was like a special thing that he had to create in order to to kill his victims. And so, you know, it has that like extra touch of, I mean, it's just, it's unique and it's really cool. And I mean, I think that's what also makes it terrifying, because you think about the, he had to, you know, really sit down and figure out and plan how I'm going to create this thing here. And then he actually created it. And of course, his backstory is he was a child murderer. So, you know, he definitely killed some kids with this glove here. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's like a lot of work. And of course, I've been listening to a lot of true crime lately. So, you know, it's like, I think about all these serial killers and all their, you know, what they do. And this is just like next level, actually creating like this whole torture device kind of thing.
It definitely sets up his level of crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And all the thing, I relate with what you just said, but what you just said is so funny because it only exists with horror fan, is he's making this scary glove because he's a child murderer, and you get to see the montage of him making it. And you just said, it's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. It is pretty cool. I mean, it's, you know, because, in a weird way.
Again, but it lives in the world of a horror movie, so you're safe. But
yeah, no, I mean, I wouldn't go out and make my own murder glove. That's no.
But it personalizes his weapon of choice.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that that's what sets him apart yet again.
Again.
From the other slashers just before him. Yeah, there's an axe, there's a machete, there's a chainsaw, there's everything, but nothing is unique to the person. And this is truly unique.
Can I ask you a question? Do you consider Freddy a monster?
I would say he's a monster. I think he fits the bill. I mean, you have to ask yourself, if you encountered him tonight, is he a monster? Yeah, most certainly. I think he's a monster only due to how he exists.
I gotcha. I'm just curious, because I know Wes Craven has said he never quite considered them like slasher films. He always thought of them as like monster films. So, you know, it's like thinking of it that way, then you'd have like Freddy, you know, Jason, all these new cats as like the second real wave of monsters, you know, whereas the first would be like the universal,
of know, course,
Dracula and all that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I never actually really thought of them as monsters. I mean, of course, they do horrific things and they're monsters in that sense. But I mean, I've never considered them as that kind of monster. But after reading that about it, I thought, you know what, that makes sense. And so there is kind of that fascination with like the supernatural that the humans have, you know, something out there that we can't explain, just a mysterious world that we live in. And so thinking about it like that, it actually really makes a lot of sense. You know, you have the supernatural force. And then of course, if you want to go with the retcon of a new nightmare and like its whole meta aspect and of, you know, this crazy entity, I guess, taking on Freddy's form, you know, I mean, it's just, I guess I would think about it in such a way that, that the monster aspect of it, at least now to me, really stands out a bit more than it used to, you know, to me, originally they were just slashers, you know, but Freddy, even then Freddy's kind of sets himself apart, because while there has always been some sort of supernatural aspect to the others because of their like their crazy psycho strength and their endurance and ability to survive all sorts of things. I mean, Freddy literally is dead, has been killed, and he lives in a dream, you know, in a dream world. So
that is part of his hook, is that Maybe, yes, he is the monster. Yes, he is a slasher, but maybe he's only a monster due to you, the dreamer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his monstrous acts that he commits to you are because of he's preying on your fears.
So I mean, invite him to tea then and he'll be okay.
Yeah, like be afraid of tea.
Right.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
We'll
be
work
afraid
it out,
of drinking tea, like something that you're ready to do.
Right.
But yeah, because I mean, like, look at that in Dream Warriors. I mean, that's a perfect example of him killing through the fears and the hopes of the dreamer. Right. You know, welcome to prime time. And he became a TV. You know, he had syringe fingers for Taryn.
Oh yeah, that one. Yeah, that one used to freak me out.
Yeah, I forget his name, but the boy who's fantasizing over the nurse.
Oh.
The nurse turns into
I don't remember
Freddy,
her name either.
And she's still a nurse, but she has Freddy's powers, and he's dreaming, and he's mute, like he can't speak.
Right, right.
So
I remember that part.
She shoots tongues around his wrists and ankles, I guess because he's tongue-tied, and the bed gives way, and it's like a bottomless pit into hell, essentially. Which, so
before you go on, what is it with Freddy and tongues? Like when Nancy's on the phone as well. I mean,
yes, I'm your boyfriend now.
Yeah, I don't know, man. This guy's got
a thing. Maybe that's a personal choice by the production team, being like, you know what's common. And you know what's gross is another person's tongue coming on to you. Yeah. Like an uninvited tongue is pretty rough.
Yeah. I think I draw the line there.
Like a tongue through the phone while you're talking on it. That's pretty gross.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. Yes, they do. Oh my God. Yeah. Because Freddy's got the really long snake lasso tongue in New Nightmare.
New Nightmare, yeah. So yeah. It's like a thing.
So
it's one of his things, I guess.
Yuck.
Yeah.
But maybe that's because he's a gross old man, and there is suggestion and mention that he was also a molester as well.
That's true. Yeah, and that was going to be in the original script, but I guess apparently at the time there was just a whole string of that kind of incident, and so they wanted to avoid that, you know, the fear, or I guess the appearance that they were just capitalizing on that, which I get. I mean, you know, it's a lot of it. It's marketing. You got to make sure you play to a certain thing, but at the same time, it's like I think that would have enriched his backstory a little bit more. And don't they use it in the remake? I think they do use it in the remake.
Definitely.
I've only seen it once, so I don't remember. The Jackie Earle Haley one.
I think we're okay if we don't acknowledge that remake. But they do mention it throughout the series.
Right.
You know, as campy as he gets, they do mention it. You know, he's the bastard son of a thousand maniacs. And
right.
Et cetera. So, it makes sense that he's ultimately evil,
right?
But I guess that also poses a question: what are we doing rooting for him? You know, like you presented all the facts.
Yeah.
We're like, I want to see some cool kills. You know, and I'm 5 years old. I want the glove.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
no big deal.
It's funny because you do that, but at the same time, you want to see the final girl or whoever. You want to see them win it also.
Yes, you do.
You know, so it's like there's that weird dichotomy and you know, that juxtaposition of like, well, I kind of like this, but at the same time, I feel like this needs to come out on top.
Yeah. And there's so many questions and plot holes and all that stuff. But you know what I say? I have a line and I always say it. It's these are questions we don't have to ask because this is a Nightmare on Elm Street.
That's true. It's true. I mean, and in a way, there's almost like a weird Inception kind of feel to it,
right?
You know, especially like that whole ending bit where they're driving away in the car. And then, of course, the top comes down and it's got the stripes. And then Freddy takes the mom. You know, it's like, well, they were dead, but are they? And I don't know. Is it a dream? Is it not a dream? What's real anymore? You know, so you kind of get that whole like just that whole vibe of what is happening. And again, I know that was a kind of a compromise between, you know, Wes Craven and I think the producer.
Bob Shea.
That's it. Yeah.
Well, the owner of New Line at the time.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I did watch all of the alternate endings right before we chatted.
Nice.
And I'm surprised that I actually had never seen it, being such a huge Freddy fan, but I had not seen one of them.
Right.
But yeah, so the ending that we see is the midway point, the saying like, okay, all right. What Bob wanted was Freddy driving the kids in the car.
Yeah.
Okay. So Wes didn't like that.
And I get that. I mean, that's a weird ending. If you're going to do a twist, I think there's a lot of other better twists you could do than just Freddy driving the kids in a car. I mean, that's just, like it seems like it comes out of nowhere, you know.
It does. And the version that was filmed, because I love seeing the villain, but yeah. I love the fact that I've never seen this shot before, and it's him full makeup and well lit, which is uncommon for Nightmare on Elm Street 1, is a well lit Freddy, and he's behind the wheel of the car and he's like driving, and it's super campy, and it definitely takes away from the scariness of it, I think, for me.
Gotcha.
So in any case, that was that scene where he's like driving off and the mom's like waving, watching them go. She doesn't get sucked into the portal of the door, essentially.
Gotcha.
But then there's like alternate more endings, right? And mm-hmm. ones without the hard top or the top coming up on the car, and okay. them just driving off, and either Marge standing there waving, and then focusing on the kids with the skipping ropes downing 1, 2, implying that he's still there.
Right.
Or she gets sucked into the door and Heather sees her sucked into the door, which is also kind of terrifying as a dream for a kid, right? To see that happen. Yeah. So I like the ending they ended on, personally. Mm-hmm. I think if that's a compromise, I think it's great.
Well, we also have, like you said, like 35 or whatever years, you know, of experience with it at this point. So, you know, it's like, as much as I love the Richard Donner cut, I think it's actually a superior cut. I like Richard Lester's version because that's what I've seen so much more of, you know, Superman 2.
Oh, yes. I was like, are we talking about Goonies again?
No. I love Goonies. We're talking Superman 2. You know, so, I mean, it's like, you know, it's, I get it. I totally know where you're going. Or like the people that like the voiceover in Blade Runner, you know, because that's what they grew up with.
Executive VIP cut, final cut.
The final cut,
mm-hmm. However many final cuts that you want to have. It's like when a band breaks up and they're like, oh, we're on their farewell tour.
Yeah.
For the third time. For the fourth time.
I imagine they get pretty bored.
But I think I heard when I was younger, and I still am, I'm a Rob Zombie fan. Not so much the movies, but the
okay, anyway. I was gonna stop you there. Like, are you sure?
Okay, listen, I really love White Zombie, Astro Creep 2000, that album.
Yep.
And Rob Zombie's first solo album, Hellbilly Deluxe, those two together. Ooh, chef's kiss. They're both good. In any case, he said in an interview once, they said, how do you feel about More Human Than Human still being used in action trailers? And he goes, I'm fine with it because I get to buy a devil head every year. I was like, he's got the right mindset. He's like, I might play metal, but if they want to expose it, I'll reap the benefits.
Yeah. Might as well. Yeah. I mean,
yeah,
you know, I would.
That's excellent. Yeah. But to that point, that mindset, mm-hmm. let's shift it over to Wes. Wes was not a big fan of where they took Freddy.
No. And I remember reading that. And I mean, I get it. They really did go camp with him, which I don't know. I kind of like it, something about him. It's just, you know, he's more playful. He's like, oh, you little scamp. But, you know, he'll cut you open. But but at the same time, like, there's just much more personality. It's just more mm-hmm. interesting to watch than just a guy who doesn't say anything going around just, you know, chopping people. And I know I just did a motion, and this is such a, this is the best medium for it, you know, visual bits always kill on a podcast, but, you know,
like, it's just, look at this and then not talk about it.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for you guys at home, too bad you missed it.
This was groundbreaking shit.
But, you know, I mean, it's just one of those, I like that Freddie could actually do that and just really get into it. I mean, it was more interesting, to be honest.
Well, okay. Let's take a, because so far this whole thing has been a sidebar. Mm-hmm. Cause that's my life. My brain runs as a sidebar.
That's all right. We're talking about it. It counts.
Yeah. Okay. So you being a traditionally Christmas based show.
Yeah.
Just enamored with the 80s, the nostalgia of the toys and the music and the comics and the TV, everything about it.
Right.
Freddy fits the bill of any like weird comic character on TV that has child appeal. So, you know, he's right up there with, you know, like a Beetlejuice or really like a He-Man villain that you kind of are like okay with. You know, and you know, he's not too far removed from that world. So no wonder by 1991, Freddy's Dead, we're seeing a 3D Freddy and him with a power glove on killing someone in a video game. It's not too far-fetched for that world.
Right.
But as a fan and a viewer, you're like,
what's going on?
Well, at least it's part six. You know, we're starting to like get to that point in the series where you're like, okay, we can just slide that one aside there.
Right. Yeah.
That's how I feel about Jason X. I'm so glad it's so far into the future that I'll be dead before they officially reach that time period.
Right.
So we can just fill the gap between now and then.
No. And you're right. I mean, what was the 80s if not excess? So, I mean, Freddy really as a slasher, as a villain, he really fits that bill, that excess, you know? So I mean, no wonder I dig him as a horror villain.
He's Motley Crue.
Yeah.
He's all in. He's crazy. He's dangerous. People like him.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point. That's a really good point. I like that.
Now, if Freddie was a Motley Crue song,
Freddie Crue,
he'd be Dr. Feelgood. He's got the big bucks. He's got the hits. You know, people like him. He's got the hook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've always enjoyed their, Take Me to the Top. I think that one's always been one of my favorites.
Oh, from Too Fast for Love.
Yeah.
Take me to the top. Yeah.
Yeah.
Get that shuffle beat.
I'm down with it. But I like just about anything musically. There's so much that I really enjoy. I think Blue Oyster Cult's probably my favorite, which is you don't really hear that very often, but I just
No.
Yeah.
But yes. Yeah. I mean, Don't Fear the Reaper. God, what was that one that I
Burning for like? You.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah. Godzilla,
of course,
but they're, I mean, I really love their more obscure songs better. They came out with that album and what was it like 98 or 99? Oh man, that has Harvest Moon on it, man. Now that album was just fantastic. No good. I mean, no hits, nothing that charted. Nobody even knew they came out with an album, but man, it was just a great album. But anyway, now we're like really getting way off topic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There will be lots of like cut sections, I'm sure.
You know, it's not a podcast if you don't go off topic every once in a while. But
Wait, how can we tie in Blue Oyster Cult to Nightmare on Elm Street?
Don't Fear the Reaper, you know.
Ah, well played, sir. I could totally see Freddy playing a cowbell in someone's nightmare.
I could too. Can you imagine just like literally Will Ferrell, like not Robert Englund, just Will Ferrell with the makeup on playing cowbell in that Will Ferrell way? I mean, doesn't that just like like just make you smile?
Yes. Yeah. That's amazing.
But you're right. So they discover that Freddie is the one behind it. Nancy's escaped a few times his clutches at this point. He's killed Tina, he's killed her boyfriend. And so I like how she decides to just set up some traps and she's gonna pull him into the real world, just like she pulled his fedora into the real world when they were doing the sleep study on her. Which, okay. Come on, like you could be the biggest skeptic, but if like a hat literally materializes out of thin air, you think you might pay a little more attention to what your daughter's actually saying?
No. Not when you're drunk like Marge. Like you're starting to see why John left her.
Yeah, for real. It's like, come on, lady, come
on. Well, there's that scene, they're in the kitchen, and they kind of switch roles there. She's acting childish, she's acting like the adult, you know?
Yeah.
So
she was crazy. But I loved her overacting. Like, out of everyone in it. It's like next level, like soap opera. God. I mean,
yeah.
Nancy,
what was that? Yeah. Don't fall asleep in there. You could drown.
That's exactly what I was about to say.
Oh, for Pete's sake. Yeah.
Oh man. Oh. There's so many great lines in this film. It's just, they're just ridiculous. You know, the lawnmower one. We'll get to it. But but yeah, so she succeeds, and I mean, well, she doesn't really pull him into the real world, I guess, until later. You know, she turns her back on him. I like how he gets set on fire essentially, and kind of goes the way he went.
Yes.
And you know, there's something poetic about that in its own way.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But yeah,
I think there's also a Dawkins song about that. Into the Fire.
Oh yeah.
another tie-in offshoot. 80s metal. I'll always find a reference.
Nice. Again, real quick, who's your favorite 80s metal artist?
80s?
Yeah.
80s? Oh.
Yeah.
I still say Motley Crue is my favorite.
Okay.
They were the ones that took themselves the most seriously out of all of them.
Yeah.
And whenever they put out an album, it created a tone for the other bands of that same year era. So girls, 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 they got rid of the makeup. They put on the leather.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, everyone's got leather and no makeup.
Mm-hmm. Looking at you,
Kiss. I just see them as like the benchmark of what is well-produced hair metal.
That's cool. I dig
There are more talented guys, no question. But when you're talking about... when you're talking about the product of hair metal,
yeah,
I don't know, man. I think Motley Crue hits it for sure.
All right, I dig it.
Honorable mention, hot take, Wasp.
Really interesting. Didn't they have a
they're
rock
super
opera?
Bad boys. What's that?
Didn't they come out with a rock opera?
Oh yeah. Okay. Headless Cross or something like that.
Something. Or, yeah, yeah. I don't remember. I just I had a friend who was like super into him. And she was like, you got to listen to this. And at the time I was big into like, The Who's Tommy. So I was like, so she was like, it's a rock opera. I'm like, I'm in, let's do it. And, I remember listening to it being like, okay, I get it. And that's about it. You know, I didn't really go anywhere from there, but no, I was always more of a Metallica guy. You know,
well,
but if we're doing hair metal, if we're doing hair metal, I think the ones with the catchiest, well, no, I guess Motley Crue did have the catchiest songs. Because, or I'd say they'd have more catchy songs than all the others.
Yeah. And not the bad catchy. Like, you know, Every Rose Has Its Thorn. I mean, that's probably the Wonderwall of the 80s.
Everybody loves Wonderwall.
What did Cinderella put out that people like?
White Lion.
Oh. Or Winger, Y&T.
King Cobra. You remember them?
Oh, from Canada, you had Striper.
Striper, no. Yeah, yeah.
Was it? Were they Canadian? Yeah. The Christian metal?
The Christian metal band, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Nothing like putting Jesus into the sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
I guess that would necessitate eliminating those three, huh?
Wouldn't it?
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. I don't know how to seg from there. So I'm just going to do a hard cut.
Yeah, just do what I do. I cue in that sound of that, you know, like the channel changing, cuz then you just move right on. You just move right on.
But yeah, I mean, so iconic, Freddie. I mean, what else could we say about him that we haven't already said? It's one of those, he's right up there. I'd say he's at the top of the list of you know, this second wave of monsters or creatures or slashers or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
Just everything about him is great. But because of that, you know, it does make me wonder, what would you say would be your happiest moment or memory of A Nightmare on Elm Street?
Well, the happiest moment that would make me most nostalgic. Well, it's not when Bing Crosby tap danced with Danny K. It's definitely the opening is my most nostalgic from that movie, is him building the glove.
Yeah.
It's absolutely terrifying to watch that come together. And when he goes, ah, like that in the camera, like that yep. still gives me chills, because it takes me back to when I was a kid and going like, oh, because it is scary. And mm-hmm. the big title that, and it just says Nightmare on Elm Street, and the, it's just like that whole sequence.
Yeah.
That's the tone for the movie. And it's still ingrained in me. Like, chills still happen when that happens. I love nice. It. Absolutely love that thing. But yeah, I mean, aside from Freddy, the icon being right. the most nostalgic from that,
right.
that scene alone does it for me every time.
Nice. Yeah. That's a good
what
one.
What about you?
For me, I think I'd have to be Tina's death. You know, yeah. something about just the way she was spinning around and kind of climbing on the walls, and then, you know, her body's being tossed around and she like hits her boyfriend. I don't know why I can't. Was it Rod? I can't think of his name at the moment. You know, and he's just helpless. He can't do anything. She's literally being killed by this invisible force. I mean, yeah, I remember real. being terrified of that, and you know, not wanting to, like, I think it was like and yes, I was 12 when I saw it, but still, but it was just one of those. Where, you know, it's like, okay, maybe I do want to leave this little light on in the closet for now or something. You know, it was really just an iconic scene for me, that every time I think about A Nightmare on Elm Street, that's the first thing I think of, is that,
sure.
you know, and just the slashes appearing all of a sudden, you know, and knowing that it's Freddy, even though you can't see him. Mm-hmm. Like you said, he's everywhere. He's invisible. He's everything.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Good stuff,
yeah,
man.
That's incredible. Yeah, that's wicked.
Yeah.
But I like how they foreshadowed the slashes on the chest by her dreaming
yeah.
and her mom saying, you got to cut those nails or quit that dreaming, one or the other. And it's like, what? Like, how is that one or the other?
How do you just stop dreaming? You know?
Yeah. Well, you gotta cut that dreaming out. It's like, okay.
All right, I'll work on it.
Yeah. Now, apparently her dad was played by, it's either Johnny Depp's stepdad or manager that comes into the scene, and he says, come on back to the sack.
Yeah, he does say that.
That's it. And he was super thrilled for that to happen. That's what they talked about on the commentary that I watched tonight. Even nice. Wes didn't know. He was like, he's either Johnny Depp's stepdad or manager, but he was really thrilled to be in the scene.
That's awesome. Are you kidding? I would too, to like come yeah, out in a movie
probably
like that.
Didn't have to pay him anything.
Probably not. Yeah. Or if they did, it was like scale, you know.
Here, have lunch.
He's an extra, so maybe like $10 or $15 a day. I don't know.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Love it.
So that's awesome.
Yeah.
But now we come to my favorite part of the show, which is a little segment I like to call Gag Me with the Spoon. So this is where we do our best impression of our least favorite part of the movie.
Oh.
Now, as a guest, I'll let you go first, unless you want to do something, unless you wanted to do one of those scenes that we had talked about doing together, in which case we can totally do that. But it's just something fun. I love doing impressions, and why not? I'm not great at them, but I like doing them anyway. So,
you know, oh, yeah, of course.
And it's
nothing better than a bad impression.
Exactly. So,
so now for like a one line that I don't like.
Mm-hmm.
Or that's super cheesy, is anything Marge says, really.
Yeah, yes.
Like, at the end of the film, after watching it tonight, I'm like, yeah, that's actually really, really cheesy. It's because it's the ending dream. It's the fogginess,
mm-hmm.
the mistiness setting in. And she's going, like, full on, like, leave it to Beaver. Everything's fine. Like, yeah. God, I just want to get the correct line for it, though.
Okay.
Oh, I feel like $1 million. They say you've bottomed out when you can't remember the night before. That's, to me, that's probably one of the worst lines of anyone in the film.
Yeah.
Because it's said with such hokiness and, like, pick me up. That it's supposed to set some sort of tone for, like, oh, we're just going to start the rest of our lives. Because you know what? What happened behind is just behind us.
I know all your good. Friends were murdered, but it's okay. Look,
it's all
they're
good.
Right here. Yeah.
Hey, look, they're going to pull up and pick you up in the Cadillac as if nothing happened.
Or did it?
Anyway, what's your line?
I like, so I also went with Marge. I actually went with when she's explaining to Nancy what they did.
Yes.
And this is the line that I didn't like. Okay, let's see. It was, "We took gasoline and poured it all around the place and made a trail of it at the door. We lit the whole thing up and watched it burn. He's dead now. He's dead because mommy killed him."
Yuck. Like,
come on. She's she's what, 16, 17? Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. You're really saving her.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. The omission of truth is just really saving that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh man. Yeah. You know, that that does make me wonder though. You know, G.I. Joe, they taught us that knowing is half the battle. What do you think the other half is?
Well, for Nightmare on Elm Street, I think half of the battle is not being related to any of these people.
I think you're right.
That'll keep you safe. But if that is impossible, not believing in Freddy is what's going to keep you safe. Because Nancy proved that did she? She proved at the end that...
I'm starting to wonder now. I don't know anymore.
Well, if nothing else from the Nightmare series, if you believe in him and you're afraid of him, then Freddy exists.
Yeah.
So as long as you're not afraid of him.
Doesn't he kill her in the third one?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a bummer. Yeah.
It's a bummer.
It is. I was hoping she could go on and live her life, but oh well. Well, that's better than mine. Mine is so if knowing's half the battle, the other half is pulling a fedora out of your dreams.
Oh.
You know, might as well. Just, whoosh, here you go.
Yeah. And just quit that kind of dreaming.
That's right. Yeah. Just you gotta one or the other. Man. Matt, it's been fun talking with you about this. What do you want to plug? Like, tell me about your show, man.
Oh, right. Yeah, I have a show. So we have recently brought on a dear friend of ours. His name's John. And so now there's three of us. Now, I thought that could have been a cluster at the best of times. But so now myself, Kyle, and John, we've actually played in bands together. And we've been musical friends for a long time. But
nice.
Turns out that Kyle and I, we exist in the horror world. John and I exist in the Seinfeld world. So now nice. The Soul Junk is really starting to expand on more about nothing. And so we have some sessions already recorded. We do a Seinfeld episode, which we're editing.
It's the Moops.
We actually build the Lego Seinfeld set.
That's cool.
Yeah, and we have some footage of it happening in time lapse. That's pretty sweet.
On. Yeah.
So we just put out our most recent episode on top concerts or video concerts from our past. So, you know, like you would have popped in the VHS or the DVD, and what really takes you back. So for me, obviously being a lifelong metalhead, that exists with Korn. And now I'm not a Korn fan anymore, but when we're talking about things on nostalgic sense, it's
right
all in the back. So yeah, the Korn VHS, Who Then Now. We talked about Pantera, the Vulgar Video, Rewatch Go.
I haven't thought about them in a while.
Oh my God. Just all the stuff from the 90s that really hit home. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
So that was a really fun episode. Really, really loving the expansion of discussion beyond the horror. As much as I love horror, we definitely want to talk about more.
Right.
So lots of really cool things coming up. And tomorrow night, we're actually going to a local brewery called Propeller. And they're screening a movie that we recorded an episode about a couple weeks ago called Siege. And it's filmed and set here in Halifax, which never happens.
Oh,
so we're actually going to watch it in the brewery, which actually served as a part of the film in 1983. So it's kind of cool to see
that
it come full circle.
That's super cool, man.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Yeah, I dig it. And where can they find you?
Wherever you get your podcasts. You just search for Nostalgia Junk.
Right on. Social media?
At Nostalgia Junk Pod. Everywhere.
Cool. Right on. Yeah, I dig it, man. And definitely check them out. It's fun. It's like they just have a blast. You can tell. And so you have a blast listening to it. So definitely check out Nostaljunk.
I wheeze a lot.
I get it. Oh, man. This was so much fun. Thanks again.
Yeah, dude. Thank you. Thank you for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, we'll have to do it again sometime for sure.
Definitely.
On that note, I'm going to end it by saying, whatever you do, don't fall asleep. So check us out on our social media pages, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you're feeling like Nancy driving away with her friends, leave us a review on iTunes. Not only does it help us reach more people, but you also get a free sticker. Now, don't forget to check out our merch shop on tpublic.com. Later, dudes.
This is the Nostaljunk Podcast, where one person's junk is another person's childhood. I'm Matt McGraw.
And I'm Kyle Smith. Join us each week as we take a deep dive into your pop culture consciousness and discuss everything from movies, TV, music,
cartoons, toys, video games, and more.
And we want to hear from you, so connect with us. Nostalgia means so many different things to so many different people, so share with us your favorite piece of nostalgia.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Nostaljunk Pod, and you can subscribe to us on all the major podcast platforms. Let's get this thing up to 88 miles per hour, and we'll see you next week.